Okay, good afternoon, everyone. So last time we started talking more about assembly, starting with AT&T syntax, that strange assembly syntax we'll be using for the rest of this class, because our textbook uses it, and a bunch of tools we're going to use it. And we talked about converting C to assembly, which I've gathered from teaching this before that people don't have that much practice with from 2150, and a bunch about how condition codes actually work. So you kind of learned in 2150 the two instruction comp jump conditional sequence, giving you the impression that conditional jumps only work with comp, but that's not how it actually happens in x86. x86, every single instruction that does arithmetic basically sets these condition codes, which tell about what the result is. And using those, that's how the conditional jumps work. Yes?
Are condition codes initialized to something? So the very first instruction in your program is a conditional jump.
So the question is, what's the initial value of the condition code? So what if I do a conditional jump with nothing before it? What's going to happen? And hopefully, the operating system sets the condition codes to the consistent value when your program starts. Who knows if that's guaranteed, but just like you'd expect the operating system to set, say, RAX to a consistent value, you might expect that for the condition codes. You might not. But it would be the operating system's job. So one thing which I think was less clear than I wanted it to be was the condition codes as used by the conditional jump instructions are named based on subtraction. In particular, this is not maybe entirely obvious unless you think about it, this means that if the result of the last thing was zero, that's jump equal will say, yeah, let's go. If the result is positive, jump greater than will say, yes, that was right. So they're named based on subtraction, but they'll interpret the results of other operations the other way. So basically, they're just looking, is it zero, positive, or negative? That's what all those conditional jump instructions do. They just have names, which assume you did a comp. Yes?
So if you did addition and the result was zero, would jump equal?
So the question is, if I do addition and the result is zero, will jump equal go to the specified location? Yes. That is exactly how it will work. So any questions about anything else from last time? Okay. So one matter about the quiz. So there was one question on the quiz which very few people got right. So I'm going to go over that. That was asking, what does this assembly snippet, which I've added some hopefully explanatory comments to, do? And you can see here that we first move the stack pointer into RAX. So RAX contains a pointer. Then we push that pointer onto the stack. And you might say, OK, so you need to look for us reading that pointer again later or something like that. But you can tell you don't need to do that because none of the other instructions here access memory. So the only effect that matters for the snippet of that push instruction is that it changes where the stack pointer points. Because when you push onto the stack, or pop from the stack, we need to move the stack pointer, and the push instruction is going to do that. And since we're pushing 8 bytes, that's what the Q stands for, it moves it by 8. So it changes the value of RSP. And then we subtract RSP and RAX. Since the push instruction just moved the stack pointer by 8, and we're subtracting RAX, which has the old value in it, we're going to get 8 from that subtraction. We know it's positive 8 because of which direction the stack grows. And then we have this funny LEA instruction. And if you remember, the LEA instruction, it's written like a memory access. So it looks like kind of like a move would. But we don't actually access memory. We just compute the memory address as if we were going to access memory and then stop and use that value. So we compute this memory address of getting RAX plus RAX times 2. And then that's the value we use and put it into, I think I wrote this correctly on the, hopefully I wrote this correctly on the, this is, should be RAX, okay, into RAX, if I correct what I copied onto my slide. And I believe that's correct. Yeah, that's definitely correct in the quiz, because I tested the quiz by copying it into a .s file and compiling it and running it in a debugger, which was an option for you to do. Like to note, like when we give you a code snippet on a quiz, you have a computer in front of you. You are allowed to run code. Yes?
So we're actually allowed on the quizzes to like stick things into compilers and IDEs and whatnot?
Absolutely. You're allowed to look up lecture slides, just you aren't allowed to talk to other students, etc. But yeah, I'm not doing anything to stop you from using those resources. Yeah. Like, if you want to be sure of your answer, go ahead and do that. Any other questions? Yes. Yes, you can run code. And I felt that was perfectly fine for this question, especially because one of the options was it depends on what the initial value of the stack pointer was. So you at least needed to understand this code well enough to know whether or not that was true, for example. Yes? So the way I ran it is by I made a .s file, which contained a main function, which I needed to declare with .global, which hopefully you did in 2150. And then I opened that up into the debugger so I could see what the value of rax was. And I'm not going to stop you from doing things like that. I don't have the need to supervise you to prevent you from doing that. And you're probably going to learn something, hopefully, by doing it. So, it's fine. Now, I might, on a test, ask you similar questions, and you won't have a compiler. So, you should be aware of that. That, you still, I do expect you to be able to do that, but on a quiz, you're in front of a computer, I don't expect you not to use it. So, with that, beyond the quiz, let's talk about labs. So, this week's lab, we're going to give you some pointer-heavy code in C, and we're going to have a tool that you'll hopefully use in lab, which will help find malloc and free related mistakes in that code, tell you where they are. It will give you like a stack trace, a call trace, telling you this is where you allocated something and this is where you used it wrong, like you accessed outside the bounds of an array, or something like that. And we're going to give you some broken code. It's a circular doubly linked list implementation, so kind of like a doubly linked list, but not quite. The kind of part is so you don't just look up what a normal implementation looks like and compare. And your task in the lab is to fix it. And we have a tool that we have the lab set up to use that should help you, but if you want to do it without that, it's perfectly fine with me. And you're done with the lab if this tool we're giving you shows no errors. But if you don't manage to fix all the bugs, there is still full credit for something less than no errors, but I'm not going to tell you how much because I don't want people leaving lab as soon as possible. But it should be whatever you get done in the lab time should be enough, assuming you're actually working. Yes?
So is that tool on the lab computers?
Yes, it's on the lab computers. The tool is on the lab computers, and it's built into GCC in Clang. It's something called Address Sanitizer.
So we can or cannot SSH?
So you can SSH, and as I said, it's built into GCC in Clang, so you probably also have it elsewhere. But we have it set up so you can download it and run it on the lab computers with the instructions we give you, without any problems. So there's no homework after this lab, and that's because next week's lab, there is an in-lab quiz. And for that quiz, in the lab time, without notes of any kind, without consulting the internet, in front of the lab machines while TAs are watching you, you need to implement two C functions, basically string len, and a slightly simplified version of the C standard library function string sep. These are described in the lab write-up, and we even have exact code for those functions in the lab write-up. Now, you aren't allowed to look at the lab write-up while you're coding these functions. as I said, no notes, but if you want to memorize them, that's fine. We don't think that's the best strategy because you should have an idea what they're supposed to do. The goal of this is to make sure you have some competency with pointer manipulation and such. Yes?
Will free quizzes start next week as well?
I will check textbook availability and decide that by Thursday. Yes? So the question is, will this take the whole time? These exercises, for most people, are much shorter than the full lab time. I would note that as part of this, you need to go to your lab section so we don't run out of machines. If that doesn't work for you, you should contact me in advance. Yes?
Just to clarify, we can look at the lab right up before the quiz.
Yes, you can look at it before the quiz, and you'll have access to the environment we will have you use in lab before the quiz, but before the in-lab quiz, but it just won't count. And that should be working by Thursday, if it doesn't work already. Any other questions? Okay. So, as promised, let's move on to more detail about condition codes. So I mentioned the trick with our conditional jump operators, they're named based on subtraction. And so this tells us the important information we actually need to keep track of for these condition codes. So somehow the condition codes tell us, is it zero, is it negative, is it positive? And that information is represented somehow in the machine. So one way we could represent that is we could have some hidden register that just stores the last result. But XD6 does something a little more compact. So in XD6, the condition codes consist of 4 bits plus some other bits that aren't relevant to this class. So one of them is called ZF. It's called for the zero flag. And it says, was the result of the last thing equal? So after you do any computation, it compares it to zero every time and stores this bit in this special register called the zero flag. And then there's another bit called the sign flag, which stores whether the result is negative. And if you remember 2's complement, the way you tell that is you just look at the sign bit. So it stores a copy of the sign bit from the last computation in a special register. There's also 2 other flags which deal with overflow and underflow. So one of them is called the carry flag, and it says, did this the last computation overflow, like a subtraction or addition? Overflow, underflow also counts for this, when we treat it as unsigned numbers. Which is exactly, in addition, was there a carry bit that you didn't get to use? There's also the overflow flag, which did this computation overflow if we treated this signed number. So did we add 2 positive numbers and get a negative one, for example? And we need to keep track of these so the compare instruction does the right thing, even if that subtraction that we're doing doesn't produce the right sign of the result. So in GDB, you can actually see these when you type in for registers. These are part of the eFlags register in GDB. So if you print out eFlags, it will show you a number and a description which might include ZF if the ZF flag is set, and SF and so on. Okay. So the way this works is that whenever we do something which sets the condition codes, like a comp instruction, so we compute that result. So in this case, it's 30, and the computation is subtraction. So here we do that subtraction, we get positive 30 as a signed number and positive 30 as an unsigned number because it's the same thing. That's how 2's complement works. That's why we're using 2's complement. And that's not zero, so the zero flag's going to be false. So how about the sign flag? What should the sign flag be? Remember, the sign flag indicates whether it's negative. So this is positive. The sign bit of the result of this computation is zero, so the sign flag is going to be zero. And most of the time, this gives us all the results we need for jump equal, jump less than, and so on. But we have to worry about that overflow case. So for example, in this case, when we treat this as sign numbers, the result is correct. We got exactly the value we expected. But if we treat this as unsigned numbers, we subtracted a very large value from a smaller one and got a positive number. And that's not the right result if we treat these as unsigned numbers. So that means that the overflow flag, which is it wrong for signed, is zero, because it was correct there. And the carry flag, which is it wrong for unsigned, is one, because it's not right. Yes? Okay. And the various jump operators will look at a combination of all these flags together to decide what to do. So the jump operators you're used to using, JLE, JL, look at signed arithmetic. So they're going to look at the overflow flag, the signed flag, and the zero flag. There are some other conditional jump operators you may or may not have used, which pay attention to the unsigned overflow. You might see these, for example, in your bombs. And that's how they can get different results for signed and unsigned comparisons. So any questions about what went on here? Yeah? The importance of
the flags.
Which flags? So
just like all in general, like
so the question is, why are these flags important? So these flags are the only thing that say jump less than is gonna care about.
So it's like the inside of like a jump
state. Yes. So jump, so if I had a jump less than instruction here, this reads ZF plus SF plus OF. That's how it works. It doesn't, so all that matters is what last ended up in ZF, SF, and OF. It doesn't matter anything else for that jump less than instruction, less equal. And that's going to be generally true. And we also need to know this because you're going to eventually implement a processor in a simulator, and you need to implement conditional jumps. So you need to know how are you going to store information so the conditional jump instruction can execute. Yes?
So how would you know if it also looks like the unsigned?
How do you know what?
If it also looks like the unsigned, like if it looks at both signed and unsigned.
So, okay, so when do we look at the signed versus unsigned, you mean, is it your question?
Yeah.
So there's different conditional jump instructions which look at signed versus unsigned. So we have know about jump less than equal. There's, for example, a jump below equal, which looks at ZF plus SF plus CF. This is the unsigned below or equal. So you probably haven't used these, but you might see them in your BOM, for example, and they exist to support unsigned comparisons. Yes?
What do you mean when it says incorrect for unsigned?
So what do you mean when it says incorrect for unsigned? So the actual result we expected for unsigned is this number. And that's not the number we got, just because it can't be represented. Any other questions about this? Okay, so with that, here's an exercise. What are the condition codes after this compare instruction? And you can check your answers with your neighbor and see. You agree. Yes?
What's the -2 asterisk?
Oh, sorry, that is to the power of. So to the 63. Yes.
Star-star operator, that seems like the
parent
operator.
So the question is, what's the star-star? That's exponentiation. I'm sorry, I wrote it two ways. Yes. Yeah. You can tell that it's, because the only one bit set, that it must be a power of 2. And I don't expect everyone to have their 2's complement memorized. Yes. That is one way of doing this. Yeah.
So we should have 2. Like,
that would be how I do it by hand. But it's one operator which does both in the hardware. I just figure out both possibilities. Okay, who has an answer to this? Who at least knows the first 2? Okay. So anyone want to volunteer to go through the first 2, at least?
00.
Over there? Yeah.
00.
It's both 0s, so why?
Because the answer is not 0, and it's also positive.
So it's positive. And you know it's positive because when we do that subtraction, we're just manipulating the bits, we're going to get the bit pattern for 1. That's not going to have the sign bit set, no matter what the real result is. So how about overflow and the carry flag? Anyone can tell me either of those, how I would figure that out? Yeah.
I said the overflow flag would 1, because like when you're using sign like values, you're going to end up with like a very like low negative that would trigger overflow, I believe.
So very low, okay, negative, that would flow. Yeah, so when we're doing the subtraction, we're getting a positive number, we found out, we've just mentioned. But we're subtracting a large signed value from a slightly smaller in magnitude 1. So it should be actually be negative. But that's not what we get. So that case, we know there is overflow. And if we think about the unsigned case, as unsigned numbers, we're getting a positive result. We expect a positive result. Everything's fine. And it's subtraction, so that's what we're looking for going wrong. It's in addition, it'd be different. Yes?
Can you go over why that would overflow if it was signed?
Sure. So I did a bit of math wrong here. That should be a plus. But if you just do the math out, you get this negative number that we can't represent at all. And that's why we get this positive 1, even though we should have this really huge negative number. And that, you can just do that in general. Just do the math out to figure out what should the result be if we had enough bits to represent it, to figure out whether you have overflow or carry. Yes?
What is SF?
So SF reflects whether the result was negative or not. Another way of looking at it is that it's just a copy of the sign bit. Just literally just take the sign, in hardware, you literally just take a wire from the sign bit and put it in a register. Okay, and as we alluded to before, this also works with things which aren't subtraction. So the principle is the same, it's just the operation isn't subtraction. In this case, it's addition. So we look at whether the addition was computed correctly for signed and unsigned. And we also look at its result for setting the zero flag and the sign flag. Yes?
Did you say that the sign flag doesn't trigger?
Sign flag doesn't trigger.
On the sign flag.
Yeah. On this case, yeah, it's negative, so it should be set. Yes? Sure. This slide? Okay, question? Or just want to copy things down? Okay. Okay. Yeah.
So if there's different results for when it's signed and unsigned, do you like make two versions of that, or do you just take?
So when the question is, when there's different results for signed and unsigned, you make two versions of that. So when I'm figuring this out by hand, that's the easiest thing for me to do. In the hardware, no, we don't compute it twice. We look at the results of the signs of the inputs and things like that, and do that. And we won't actually have you implement this in a hardware simulator, but I just wanted to make sure you understand that this exists, that we actually handle overflow. In your simulated hardware, we're just going to say, hey, if the computation overflows, we don't branch correctly, which is fine for a course like this, but not in a real processor. Yes?
How does it know whether for the OF and CF, overflow is signed?
How does it check? So we have to have something in our hardware which does the addition that gives us this information. That would be the typical way of doing it. Is that whoever constructed that piece of hardware which does the addition has not only outputs the result, but also whether it overflowed and as signed or unsigned. Yes? The question is, how do we know whether it really is unsigned or unsigned? And the way we know is that the assembly tells you nothing except that when the compiler writes a jump instruction, it will write something like JLE if it's signed, and JBE if it's unsigned. So the compiler is responsible for keeping track of, do I want to do a signed or unsigned comparison? The hardware doesn't get to find out when it's setting the condition codes. Any other questions on this? Yeah?
So would there be a situation for CF and SF where signed and unsigned would be different answers?
CF and SF? Yes. I believe you can have all combinations, especially when, because remember, we do this for like additions and other operations, multiply. So there's, yeah, you can, all the combinations I believe are possible. Yeah?
So does SF use the unsigned value to compute the result?
Does SF use the unsigned?
Yeah.
What do you mean SF? The So if we're finding out whether it's negative, we look at the result and ask, is the sign bit set? So most simply, it's easiest to think about that with the signed result, because you just see, look at it, if it's negative, but what the hardware is doing is just looking at that sign bit. which tells, and obviously we aren't testing whether it's negative as an unsigned because unsigned values can't be negative. Yeah.
Why is RBX either signed or unsigned?
So the question is, why is RBX either signed or unsigned? So this is, it's not. But we need to consider when determining whether there was overflow, both what would happen if we care about signed values or unsigned values. RBX doesn't, it's just 64 bits, and the hardware will treat it as signed or unsigned based on the few instructions that actually care about that, which, you know, include, as we mentioned, the conditional jumps, and there's a few others, but not many. Yeah.
So does signed always mean negative?
This question, does signed always mean negative? So a signed number can be negative or not. That's a way we interpret bits. The signed flag indicates whether interpreted as a signed number, something is negative. It's called the signed flag because it represents the signed bit, not because it has something to do with signed or unsigned. Okay. So, back to our C2 assembly, which we got distracted from with condition codes. Here's a brief exercise. Make sure you can read these conditional jumps. So which of these versions of this assembly is correct? And if you remember, our advice from last time is that if you want to translate something from C to assembly, a good first step is to write C with go to's first. And this would be another thing you could compare with your neighbors. Relatively quiet, so either you're completely confused or you solved this. Okay, who has an answer for A? About whether that, okay. For B, oh, sorry, who has an answer? I'm not asking whether it is or is not. Who has an answer for A? It's made a decision about whether A is a valid translation. Okay. So who thinks A is a correct way to translate this while loop into assembly? Thinks it isn't. Okay, anyone want to explain their answer? Yeah, so the first problem, and this is subtle, a common mistake, is that we're calling foo before we do the first comparison. So if b is initially 10 or bigger, we're going to execute foo one more time than the C code says to. It's obviously not the common case, but compilers can't assume you're not doing that unless they have other information to figure that out. So because of that reason, usually the most straightforward way of translating a loop like this is something like what you see in version B. So does who thinks version B is a correct translation? Thinks it is not. Okay, someone who thinks it isn't, want to, you have anyone willing to give an explanation or? Yeah. Yeah. So if RBX is less than 10, because of how comparisons work in AT&T syntax, we compute RBX minus 10, see what the sign of that is. We jump out of the loop.
Can you write out the compare?
So this compute, so what this does is it computes result is RBX minus 10. And if that's negative, then we jumped out of the loop. So that should be correct, I believe. This should be correct. Yes, okay, I didn't mess this up. I meant B to be right, but it's always possible I make this error. So I believe B is correct, because we want to jump out of the loop. This is inverted to what we were doing here. Which was wrong.
Yeah.
Another problem with that, version A. There's another way you could figure it out that version A was wrong, but the most obvious problem is we run foo before we do anything. And because of that, so then we can look at version C. So in version C, we have an attempt to convert our compare to an actual subtraction into a register we don't use. And you can immediately tell that something must be wrong here, because I'm comparing 10 with something and not, and I have greater than and not no equal case. Yeah.
I'm sorry, can you
go
through why B works?
So we compare RBX and 10. So if RBX, It is wrong. Okay. So x and x, because we call foo, I'm sorry for confusing myself twice. So this is wrong because if RBX is 0, we compute 0 minus 10 is negative, we jump out of the loop. And here, I believe, is this right? So if, same thing in reverse, which is not going to be right either, because this is not the right comparison. To reverse that, it's not the actual reverse comparison that we want. So the fix here would be that we do jump greater than equal instead of jump less than. Yes.
Could you fix version C by changing jump greater to jump less?
Question is, could you fix version C by changing jump greater to jump less than equal? Yes. And here, it should be jump less than equal. Yes.
For version C, would the subtraction
then store the value into RBX?
So the question is, for version C, does the subtraction store the value into RBX? No, it stores it into RAX.
Oh.
Which we then just don't use. We just overwrite it with 10, the next iteration. Yes?
For C, would it be jump less than or jump less than equal? Wouldn't it be jump less than?
So the question is it jump less than or jump less than equal? So if it's equal to 10, what do we want to happen? If B is 10? Jump over the loop, and that's where we're going. So if it's equal to 10, so we want to jump out of the loop, so it's jump less than equal.
I thought we would jump into it because 10 is less than. I mean, I'll
never mind
that.
Okay. So, yeah, I'm sorry for confusing directions or comparisons, but one way to figure this out is you can carefully just write this out as C and make sure it looks right to you. And that will avoid errors like trying to eyeball comparisons and getting the direction wrong. Okay. And I'd note that there are, as this suggests, a variety of options that are real compilers might use for converting loops. So these are all the sorts of things compilers would do. Hopefully I compiled the correct loop to get all this code. So why would a compiler prefer to produce this something like this third version over the first two? Yeah?
Is that because it doesn't have to add to RBX, it just decrements it?
Okay, and what's the advantage of that?
You don't have to do two things, you're just doing one thing.
Yeah, so this compiler, in the second version, we decrement RBX, and that sets the condition codes because it's arithmetic. And the compiler did all this extra work before the loop in order to have less instructions in the loop, which might help, might not. But this is the sorts of things that you might see compilers do, all reasonable ways of translating the loop. We have the second version where we get rid of the extra jump, which might help, might not. You'll have more ability to judge about that when we talk much more about how processors work, about whether that's a good idea or not. Okay, so we talked about converting while loops. So I'd like to talk about one final construct in C and how we might compile it. That is switches. So if I have a switch statement like this, switch case, most straightforward thing to do is just compile it like a whole bunch of if-elses. So can anyone think of a better way, maybe? So. Now let's say we have 100 cases, just to make it clearer where we're going. So if you have 100 cases, this ends up being often inefficient, so what would be a better idea? Yeah?
Maybe relate the A number to some address, so like jump to this place in
case. So relate number to?
Yeah, relate A to like the address of where the code is taken.
Okay, so you want to use A somehow to compute an address, okay? And even have more specific suggestions? That's a good idea. We'll get to that in a bit. Any more specific suggestions, which could be on a different, there's a different style of solution, which is also good here. It's probably like something you learned before. Yeah.
Maybe use offsets in some sort of
fun ways. Sorry, you use offsets? What do you mean by offsets? Okay, so use a table, yes. So that's the solution, is that we can have a table of where each of the cases are. And I'll show you what the assembly for that looks like in a bit. Yeah?
Use comparisons to eliminate whole blocks of case statements, so similar to binary search?
Yeah, so we could also do a binary search. So yes, binary search is one option. That's I expected someone to come up with earlier before the manipulating addresses option, but I guess you've seen parts of the BOM lab. And another option is a table. And there's this funny syntax in AT&T syntax assembly where we have this star and an address, and that means read an entry from this table, and that contains a pointer to the code we actually want to run. That's what that syntax means. So it's kind of doubly indirect about where we're going. And so we have these three options for compiling switches, and you might ask, which do compilers use? And the answer is all of them. It depends on the switch case statement. So the you might ask, which of these do compilers use? And it's all of them. It depends on the switch case statement, which they'll choose. They all have advantages in some cases and disadvantages in others. Okay. So that's basically all I'm going to say about x86 assembly stuff. And we're going to go on into our specialized little architecture of Y86. And to start that, I have a bit of a preview of Y86 condition codes. So as I mentioned earlier, in Y86, we're going to be getting rid of overflow and underflow handling. We're just not going to do it. We're going to do the wrong thing. But that will make it easier for you to complete assignments because you won't have to worry about figuring out that. But real x86 can't do that because you'd be really angry if you did a comparison and didn't work. And since we're talking, yeah.
So you say that y86 is like created for this class, like
I. Yeah. So y86 is created by our textbook authors, and it's basically a subset of x86. And one, our textbook actually doesn't remove all of this stuff, but in this course we will remove both the overflow flag and the carry flag. Our textbook removes the carry flag, but not the overflow flag. We're just not going to deal with the overflow flag either, just to save you time. Because it's not that important to understand exactly how to compute what its value is after addition and subtraction and all that. Okay, so since we're talking about a different instruction set, I want to talk generally about issues with instruction sets and hardware design. And the first thing I want to do is distinguish between the two. So there's a term we'll use in this course called a microarchitecture, which refers to the design of some hardware. So there are different ways of designing processors, even if they have the same overall interface. So for example, Intel releases generations of chips. If you look up the specs, they'll say it's like a fifth generation Core i7 or something like that. Each of these generations is a different microarchitecture. So it has a different hardware design, and that means it has different performance and efficiency characteristics because that hardware design is different. And for example, you might see implementations of processors for very low power scenarios have a completely different design than ones for, say, desktops. And one example of this is Intel historically released Atom chips, which were x86 chips designed for low power. They had a very different hardware design than the chips they were releasing for the desktops because they had different ideas about what they cared about in the hardware design. So separate from that, we have the instruction set. And instruction sets is the interface that software developers see. It's the interface visible to the software. So different microarchitectures can implement the same instruction set, which means that software works on either of them the same way. As far as what the results are and how you actually write machine code for the architecture. So this instruction set includes what the machine code looks like, what the and typically implies what the assembly looks like, and how that machine code is going to be executed. But the performance might vary, the power consumption might vary based on the microarchitecture. So clearly there's a relationship between the instruction set and the microarchitecture. Some instruction sets are going to favor some types of microarchitectures. or disallow other types of microarchitectures. So there's a couple design here. So people designing an instruction set, choosing that software interface, typically have a particular hardware implementation in mind. But that doesn't mean you can't implement it in lots of other ways. And this is certainly true with x86. So like the original version of x86 was designed in the 70s, 80s. So, you know, processor design was very different back then. And they've kept some compatibility back to that. And that means that part of this instruction set was designed for a very different implementation. But it doesn't mean you can't implement it in these new ways, which are very, very different from anything anyone was thinking about in the 70s and 80s. So we're going to take a bit of time to look at what instruction sets look like. And there are several concerns that come up when people are designing instruction sets. And there's two big competing concerns. So one is, I want it to be easy for people who are writing compilers or writing assembly by hand, or some combination of the two, to write efficient assembly or machine code. Like, I don't want that process to be ridiculously complicated. I don't want compilers to not be able to generate working machine code for my platform. I don't want them to generate machine code that does lots of extra operations because some instructions are hard to use. So that's one big concern in designing instruction sets, is I want it to be usable and efficient to use, so I have fast code. Another concern is I want it to be easy for the hardware designers. No, I don't want to have ridiculously complicated instructions that take a lot of hardware to design but maybe aren't so useful. That's not going to be worth it. I want it to be able to have the option often to have cheaper hardware that implements my instruction set, and that means I need to keep my instruction set simple enough that my hardware isn't too complicated. And I also want my instruction set to make it so I can have fast implementations, that I want to make sure that the instructions I choose are ones that, you know, I can consistently implement efficiently. Another concern is I often care about flexibility for the future. So instruction sets live forever. x86, we haven't gotten rid of it. I said it dates back to like the 80s. And this is true of most instruction sets you look at. But, you know, once you have an instruction set, people have software written using that, and they expect that to continue working, and they expect you to make more processors that do that. And that means that you can expect that your instruction set will continue to be used when you might have different ideas about both of these things. So one concern when designing an instruction set is, how do I make this work when I change how I want to design my hardware in the future? Because I know that people are going to expect to run the same OS, not have to rebuild anything and get the new version for this new architecture. It's usually not an option. So most of you are probably familiar with x86 and maybe ARM. And maybe a few other instruction sets. There are a lot of instruction sets. A lot of them. Still an active manufacturer for various reasons. So there's been a lot of time someone has decided, I can do this better, and I apparently do not. I care enough about doing this that I don't really care about software compatibility with everything that exists. And each of these instruction sets have made various different design decisions for a combination of those reasons about making things easier for people writing assembly for those instruction sets and making things easier for implementing them. You see this huge list, and this doesn't include instruction sets which are currently dead, which there are a few of, that are just aren't manufactured anymore. So you might ask, you know, how do these differ? How are these different than the sort of x86 I've seen before? What changes did they make that they think were better? And probably the biggest thing to look at are these three choices. So one is, how do we write machine code? When I write an instruction in machine code, do I end up with something of some variable length, or do I end up with something of fixed length, where there's a fixed place for everything in the instruction. Another big thing is the number of sort of, I say, right, normal registers, what are often called general purpose registers, number of registers for most operations that you can access. And this varies, and if you make this number higher, that makes it probably harder to implement compactly in hardware, but easier to write efficient assembly for, because you have less times where you load something from memory, do a calculation, store it back, load it from memory, and so on. And also the number of instructions. So having more instructions means it's more likely that if there's a fast way for a hardware to do some particular operation, well, you can expose that. It also means it's harder to implement the hardware. It also means it might be harder to write efficient assembly for the hardware because you have to figure out which instructions are actually worth using. And you can see there's huge variation in all of these. You have made decisions at all sorts of points. And these are the biggest factors that you can think of with an ISA. And there's some other choices. So any questions on any of the things here? Anything strike out to people as weird on this chart? Yeah. So what are the asterisks? So when I have an asterisk on this chart, I mean that, so for example, ARM version 7 has 4-byte instructions typically, but there are exceptions. Yeah?
Why does Itanium need so many registers?
So the question is, why does Itanium need so many registers? So you shouldn't think of it as needing so many registers, but giving you so many registers. And Itanium made, it was a very strange architecture. It's kind of going away now. But it had an architecture design where the idea was the compiler would do a lot more work. And one of the things they wanted to do to make it possible for the compiler to do a lot more work was give the compiler lots of registers to work with. It wasn't so successful, though people who code assembly for it do like having 128 registers to work with. Yeah?
Why 41 bits?
So yes. Itanium has a weird instruction encoding where you encode bundles of instructions. So it doesn't have, so that you get read multiple instructions together, that's why it can be not a multiple of 1 byte. And it happens to be work out to 41 bits for each of the instructions in a bundle. This is, yeah, there's a architecture, a hardware design they had in mind when doing this, which we may or may not get to in this class. Okay. So these are the sort of most obvious choices. And one sort of shocking thing you may notice is the variation in, you know, complexity here. That we have instruction sets with thousands of instructions, like x86. And I note that counting instructions is tricky. Like, for example, x86 has an 8-bit compare and a 16-bit compare. Are those separate instructions? Depends who you ask. But thousands of instructions versus, you know, tens or so. And also a big variation in instruction encoding. So the biggest choice with instruction encoding is whether you have a fixed length encoding or not. So in this class, we're going to have a non-fixed length encoding, but fixed length encodings, that's easier to implement in hardware. Because basically everything, you always know exactly how much stuff to get from memory every time. And also where the next instruction is every time. Yeah, assuming there's no jump. So there's some other choices that are made when you design instruction sets. So one is about condition codes. So I talked all about condition codes. This is how we do it in x86. And not every instruction set uses this. So there's another popular strategy, which is to have compare and branch instructions. So for example, on MIPS, you have this branch if equal instruction, which takes two registers, compares them to see if they're equal, and if so, jumps to the specified label. This is another choice, and there are certain advantages for some types of hardware implementations to this strategy over the condition code one. And certain advantages to the condition code one, which, like, maybe it makes it, you know, you can get free comparisons from decrementing loop counters and things like that. So this is a choice someone made when designing the instruction set about which of these was more convenient. Another big choice is addressing modes. So in x86, we have this weird four things to specify an operand in memory, and one way of specifying a register operands. Other architectures might have other operands you can specify. So ARM, for example, lets you specify a value in a register where the bits are shifted over by a constant in the instruction. That is one of the operands you can specify in many instructions, just like you can specify a register. An old architecture called VAX let you specify, I would like you to access a value as a pointer to a pointer, to reference that pointer twice, in an instruction, without writing two instructions. And these choices, so when you make support more complicated addressing modes, that makes your hardware more complicated, but it also means that it's easier to write assembly. So the x86 addressing mode is really good for accessing arrays, for example. And that's why they chose it. But it makes the hardware more complicated, because now you need hardware which can add those numbers for every instruction which accesses memory, which, if you made a simpler choice, you wouldn't need. Another big choice is the number of operands. So in x86, we have two operand instructions, typically. We have a source and a destination, which is also an input operand. Some instruction sets have chosen to have two sources and a separate destination register. So the disadvantage here is that you have to write the register numbers, or whatever, however else you specify the operands, if they're memory, in the instruction. And that takes up space. But the advantage is that it's easier to write assembly with the source destination form, because you don't have to ever copy values between two registers. You always can specify a different destination. So it might save you instructions and make your code more efficient sometimes. And VAX did both. And another big choice is just instruction complexity. So in x86, we have simple instructions like add, compare, subtract, move, and we have some really complicated instructions. So push. Push writes a value to memory and updates the stack pointer. And x86 has even more complicated instructions. So move SB is an instruction that reads a value from memory and writes a value to memory. In one instruction. And there's also a variant of it which reads a series of values from memory and writes that series to a different place in memory. That's a much more complicated instruction. And when you make complicated instructions like this, it's going to be harder to implement in hardware. In particular, a thing about all these instructions is that they write multiple values. So now that means that your hardware needs to support writing two things from an instruction, which might make the hardware implementation substantially more complicated. And if you knew every instruction, at most had to write one value. So I've talked about these variations in instruction set design, and there's sort of a big theme of two philosophies of instruction set design. This is known as CISC versus RISC. So RISC stands for the Reduced Instruction Set Computer. And you might say, reduced from what? Well, there's something called the Complex Instruction Set Computer. Our textbook goes into what they think the differences between the two are. But I think it's best to look at this from sort of a historical perspective. So back in the 70s-ish, instruction sets were really complicated. And I know you think x86 is pretty complicated, but no, they were really complicated. And this was thought to be a good hardware design principle, and some academics had this idea that, you know, maybe we can do better by making that simpler. But I'd like to show you that they're really complicated. So in particular, VAX is sort of the classic example of what people were reacting to when they said, we need reduced instruction sets. So I'm going to show you descriptions, and you can just read these, of three actual VAX instructions. These are single instructions. You can imagine how you might, what, you can try to imagine what, how you might implement this in hardware if you know. And it won't get easier when you finish this class, probably. These are pretty complicated instructions. So I told you that like writing two values from an instruction was complicated. These are way worse than that. So we have instructions with read strings, search through strings, do like a loop of computation to compute a polynomial. You might say, how do you implement this in hardware? Since we're not going to implement any instructions nearly as complicated in hardware. And at the time, there was a particular, very common implementation technique that was used. And I'm going to give you a sort of high-level description of how it works. So this instruction here, finding a string in another string. It seems like you need like a loop to look for each possible place the thing could be to find it. And that's what they did. And how did they do that? Well, for these complex instructions, the implementation technique was that they had this lookup table in the hardware where they looked up a sequence of instructions for a secret sort of simpler instruction set that implemented that. That was the common implementation technique. And this is called microinstructions or microcode. It's still a technique that's used some today, though not nearly as much as back in the VAX days. And an observation you can make is that if this is how you're implementing instructions that are complicated like this, is that you're looking up some other simpler instructions to actually do them, because you don't want to make hardware a circuit that does this. You can't, because it's a loop. You don't know how big the string is. No. Then these complex instructions, you know, might not be faster, because the simpler instructions are going to do the same actual operations. So, you know, there's not actually a fundamental reason why just because there's this match C instruction that searches for a string in another string, that's going to be faster. And they're much harder to implement. So yes, you have this convenient technique where you write software to implement the instructions. So that's at least a little easier than making a circuit. But they're still harder to implement than just writing that find string and string routine in, say, C. And certainly harder to test. And another thing that was happening around this era was that compilers were becoming popular. So around the time of the VAX, the reason the VAX had these really complicated instructions is because people were often writing assembly by hand. That was extremely common at the time. Compilers weren't very good, and so people often didn't use them. But compilers were getting better, and an observation people made is that, you know, if compilers are getting better, we can rely on compilers more, and we don't have to have all these funny features for our assembly programmers in our instruction sets. And so RISC was the reaction to this, to this observation that you weren't getting any actual speed improvement, well, not much speed improvement, from having these complex instructions available to you, because they were just implemented by doing the simpler operations you could write anyways. And that we would have compilers everywhere. You correctly predicted that you would not be writing assembly code again, you know, in 10, 15 years most of the time. So, you know, let's have a simpler instruction set. So the RISC design philosophy gives us these simplifications which are designed to make it really easy to implement fast hardware. So the biggest thing is that we have fewer, simpler instructions. So instead of having a nice, featureful instruction set with all the things assembly programmers might want, we focus on choosing the instructions that we can implement efficiently in hardware that are enough to do everything that a compiler can figure out how to choose which ones to use. Commonly, in this philosophy, we have separate instructions to access memory. So one thing that is freed up by having simpler instructions is that you can use the extra space you might gain in the hardware to have extra registers. And if you have extra registers, you can simplify your instructions further by having most instructions not access memory. So their idea is that compilers are going to figure out how to use all those registers and we're going to not have every instruction maybe have to access memory like in x86. We're just going to have separate instructions for that, that have separate hardware, and keep things simpler that way. And to keep the hardware simpler, they have fixed length instructions. So they don't want to spend lots of hardware figuring out how to look up microcode or anything like that. So they want to have the instruction decoding, reading the machine code, be really simple. And I mentioned more registers, because that's what we're going to do by simplifying all this hardware, is that we can get more things like registers that take up space but are easy to implement and might will make programs faster. Anyhow, and we avoid certain single instructions. So RISC commonly also, have fewer addressing modes, even on its memory move instructions, because that makes the hardware simple. So even the memory instructions, they're separate, and also they're, there's typically just one kind to make it easy to implement. And you can have the compiler figure out how to make good use of that one addressing mode, one way of writing a memory address. Any questions about any of these RISC choices? Okay, so as I said, we're gonna use something that our textbook made called Y86-64, which is kind of like a somewhat RISC-ified version of x86, somewhat. So it's based on x86, and we certainly have fewer instructions, so we don't have thousands of instructions for you to implement. This is the list of instructions that we've got from x86. It also has a much, much simpler encoding than x86. So it's not as simple as a RISC architecture would like, but it's much simpler than x86, which is needlessly complicated, except x86 has a lot of history. And let's go into these two instructions that changed and talk about what the changes are. So one of the changes I said is move queue is renamed. And one thing we liked with that RISC liked to do is have separate instructions for accessing memory than the ones that don't. And our variation on the instruction set is going to do this by splitting up the move instruction. So we're going to have a source and a destination as the prefix to the name of our move instruction. And we're going to have variants for moving an immediate to a register to a register, memory to a register, or a register to memory. Those are all going to be separate instructions with separate names. And we're going to omit some of the ones which would be possible. So I mentioned that RISC doesn't like having instructions which like access memory twice or something like that. So we're not going to have memory to memory move. We're going to keep things simple that way. We're also not going to have immediate to memory move. You'll have to access a register first. Any questions about these? Yeah. So what is an immediate is the question. An immediate is a constant value that appears in the instruction itself. So we also have this CMOVE CC, which you haven't seen before. So that's a conditional move. So it's exactly like a jumping over a move based on the condition codes, except it's one instruction. So this exists in x86, but you just probably haven't seen it before. So basically, it moves. It's like a register to register move. But it only happens if the condition codes match correctly with the matching, checking the same as a conditional jump. And finally, one difference is this HLT instruction, which you also haven't seen. That's to stop the processor. That's a thing we need to do. So next time, I'm going to talk about the rest of what Y86 is. And we'll review how risky it actually ends up being, how that reduced instruction set idea. That's all I have. Good luck with the lab and the homework.